Welcome to episode 11 of season 2 of Travels Through Time. Hello, I'm Artemis Irvin, and in today's episode we're heading back exactly a century to the Europe of 1920, where the Great War is over and a new world is being remade. Here was a new generation grown up to find all gods dead, all wars fought, all faith in man shaken. This quotation from F. Scott Fitzgerald is how the historian Charles Emerson introduces us to the year 1920 in his book Crucible, The Long End of the Great War and the Birth of a New World, which we'll be discussing with him in today's episode. The end of the First World War did not truly come about when the first peace treaties started to be signed, but rather was a long and arduous process that went on for years after the official conflicts had ended. That traumatic and transformative time provides the backdrop to the scenes which our guest Charles Emerson will take us back to today. Charles studied modern history at Oxford University and in Germany before taking up an Anton Corduel scholarship to study international relations in Paris. He worked for a number of years in foreign policy. Crucible, The Long End of the Great War and the Birth of a New World is Charles's third book, published at the end of last year. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Charles.
Hello.
I thought we could start by telling us a bit about what first drew you to this particular period. And why is it such fertile ground for radical ideas?
Well, I'd written a book about the year before the First World War in 1913. And I've always been interested in the way in which the chronology of 1914 to 1918 doesn't really quite fit. Maybe it fits from a British or from a French perspective, but from other parts of Europe, it doesn't quite fit. And I've always been fascinated in the period after 1918, when really the war didn't end. And there's this continuum of violence and revolutions and civil wars and famines across Europe. And this somehow often gets lost in the story of the armistice in November 1918 and the peace treaty in Versailles. Mm. And so in sort of slicing up, breaking up this chronology, I wanted to go back to what I view as being really the critical year when the clock couldn't be turned back to how things were before the war. And that year is 1917 with the Russian Revolution, of course, the two Russian revolutions, and the entry of the United States into the war. And then I wanted to extend that period of the end of the war to 1924, which is when things really settled down in Europe after the war. And I think those years are as important, if not more important, than the war itself in the transformations which occur in Europe at that time, and in basically setting up Europe on the roller coaster journey which it takes in the following years. The origins of fascism, communism, modern anti-Semitism, and these most unlikely rises of figures, such as Hitler or Lenin, for that matter, in these years, and also the fall from grace, of course, of various historical figures over that time. And that process of transformation was something I think is tremendously important, and I wanted to try and bring that to life. Mm. So that's why I wrote the book.
And that actually leads me on really nicely to the other question. I just wanted to talk very briefly about the way you've written the book, because I think that the style that you evoke actually really matches what we try and achieve with the podcast as well, about taking the reader or the listener back in time to that moment, because it's written in the present tense and it's written in snapshots or visiting specific people at specific moments. And I just wanted to ask you a bit about why you decided to write it in that way.
Well, I think because precisely for the reasons that you suggested, which is I wanted to grab the reader and for the reader to get a sense of immediacy and also a sense of uncertainty about what's going to happen next, to have that sense of jeopardy that you have if you're reading a work of fiction. Or, you know, I've written it a little bit perhaps like a film script in a way, with these quite short scenes written in the present tense in one place, generally focusing on one character, and then moving often quite radically, not in time because it's all chronological through time, but moving often quite radically in place. So you get a sense of different things going on at the same time, which are on some level connected, I think. And I think that's a very important point about the book too, is that when we're looking at the rise of particular individuals or ideologies or the falls of others, then, you know, if we look at them in at the same time, then we can see them sort of looking at each other and learning from each other and we can see them as emanations of the same zeitgeist, if you like. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to bring all that together through the style of writing.
And you've chosen the year 1920 to travel back in time to today, which is 100 years ago.
Well, it seems only fair.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's
100 years ago now.
Yes.
But I think it's also 1920 is a, it's, you know, you, if you think about the year 1917, you've got revolution. Mm. You think about 1918, you've got armistice. You think about 1919, you have the Versailles Treaty. Mm. 1920 often is presented as, well, it's the end of all that, isn't it? It's the beginning of a new decade, the beginning of the 1920s. But actually, what I would suggest is it's really not that at all. Because if you actually look at Europe in those year, in that year, 1920, you've got guerrilla war in Ireland, you've got a civil war in Russia, you've got a putsch in Germany, you've got French troops on the Rhineland, you've got all these things going on, and in some ways, this is actually really another hinge year, and it's a hinge year for the history of Europe and whether the Bolshevik Revolution, whether the Communist Revolution is able to spread out from Russia and take over the rest of Europe or not. And that's one of the critical narratives, I think, of 1920. The Versailles Treaty comes into effect in January 1920. But really, as you go through the year, you see that really the war is not over. It's just fragmented into a million different other conflicts and upheavals, cultural and political.
I think we're going to be visiting Moscow for our second scene. But first, we're in Fiume.
Yes.
We're in the Golden Platypus restaurant in Fiume. And what historical figure are we sitting at the table with in this restaurant?
So, yes, so we're at the Golden Platypus. Its actual name was the Golden Stag, but people preferred to call it the Golden Platypus. And we're trailing Gabriele D'Annunzio, this extraordinary poet, writer, propagandist, a great hero of Italian nationalism, a man who made his name during the war by doing such daring things as flying over Vienna, the capital of an enemy state, and dropping propaganda leaflets written by him, some of it actually handwritten by him, and then dropped over the population of this enemy capital in order to inform them they could never possibly hold out against the force of Italian arms. And at the end of the war, of course, D'Annunzio finds himself at a bit of a loose end, because the war's over. The war which has made his name, not just the war which has made his name, but it certainly elevated himself in the Italian public's mind, has come to an end. And he takes on this role as being essentially the figurehead of Italian nationalism. Mm. And Fiume is the touchstone city for Italian nationalists. It was promised, Italian nationalists view it as having been promised to the Italian government when they joined the First World War in the first place in 1915. And there is a fear amongst Italian nationalists in 1919 that they're being sold out from what was promised at that time. And in order to prevent that, a group of Italian nationalists led by D'Annunzio decide to march and take the city over for themselves in order to force the hand, essentially, of the Italian government and the winners of the First World War and simply take over the city. Mm. And so D'Annunzio ends up there, you know, attracting all these figures from across Italy, soldiers who also are disappointed at the end of the war and the opportunities for heroism, which they believe that represents. And he ends up creating this essentially a radical hub, if you like, in Fiume, which draws in these figures from these brigands and even schoolboys, nationalists from all over Italy, and which eventually draws in indeed figures from all over Europe. So you have members of the IRA who turn up in Fiume, seeking weapons, nationalists, Flemish nationalists from Belgium who end up coming to Fiume looking for support from D'Annunzio. And you get this extraordinarily odd environment, very festive in some respects environment in Fiume, with a lot of alcohol and indeed drugs. So the Golden Platypus would probably be quite a good place to observe that, possibly in a quiet, darkened corner while the carousing goes on.
Do you think that all of the hedonism was a really integral part of D'Annunzio's vision, what he was trying to achieve, or was it all kind of incidental and just big party?
I think the question is whether D'Annunzio really had a vision. Mm. I think he was the vision in his own mind. I mean, he certainly wanted to overthrow the Italian government, and he thought that if Fiume were to be a success, if he was successful in overtaking Fiume, then this would then result in the Italian government collapsing. And that didn't happen. But whether he had some particularly worked out organisational vision for what he was trying to achieve, I don't think he ever had that, really. He said he was sort of pushed into taking over Fiume. You know, he rose from his sickbed, persuaded by others as the great hero to go in and do his duty for the Italian nation. But I'm not sure that he had a particular vision. And certainly as time goes on, I think the notion that there could be a successful political outcome from D'Annunzio's perspective fades, and the carousing and this, you know, performative element to state things over. There's Filippo Marinetti, the Italian futurist, who visits Fiume not long after D'Annunzio takes over, and he just says it's a dream come true. And there is that sense in which this is almost not a political gesture, it's sort of a cultural gesture, a gesture, an expression of a new chaotic cultural movement.
And what is the fate of this chaotic disorder that we find in Fiume?
Well, I guess somewhat inevitably, perhaps, things don't really work out. What happens in the end is that the Italian government says that it will push D'Annunzio out. In fact, what ends up happening is there ends up being a cooperation, more or less, or at least a live-and-let-live policy between the Italian army, which is encamped just outside Fiume, and the rebels inside Fiume itself. And indeed, there's one event in February 1920 when the Italian army holds a ball on Valentine's Day, in fact, and invites representatives from the rebels in Fiume to come and join them. And then a few days later, there's a return match, as it were, where the soldiers go from the Italian army bases to Fiume to celebrate and carouse in Fiume. So there's this long period when they're sort of a live and let live approach.
Rubbing along
quite joyfully together. The Fiume regime tries to raise money by committing various acts of piracy. You know, kidnapping becomes very popular in the city. The children leave. D'Annunzio's sidekick Guido Keller has a pet eagle. I mean, it's all ridiculously over the top. And of course, it's easy to forget the people of Fiume in all of this. How are they supposed to survive while D'Annunzio is engaging in all these colourful antics? So, with on the one hand the government in Italy not changing in the way that D'Annunzio wants and expects, and on the other hand the populace of Fiume losing their support for D'Annunzio, it's inevitable ultimately that things will fall apart, and they do on Christmas Day 1920, when Italians are looking the other way, essentially, and engaging in their Christmas festivities, and that's when the Italian army finally does, having issued several ultimata, marches in and takes over Fiume, and D'Annunzio is out. I think the legacy of the whole Fiume experience is twofold. On the one hand, there is this idea of dramatic, theatrical fascism, of the melding of culture and politics, which D'Annunzio really represents, and that remains very strongly in the DNA of the far right in Italy, in the squadristi in mainland Italy, and then ultimately with Mussolini's fascism. But what it also does is it demonstrates that the Italian far right can't survive only with a showman. They need somebody who's got organisational skills as well, somebody who's even prepared to make certain political compromises, who's capable of making political compromises, and that figure is Benito Mussolini. So Mussolini, who's essentially D'Annunzio's PR man back in Milan during the Fiume adventure, he emerges as a realistic leader of the far right, practical political leader of the far right. Whereas D'Annunzio, he's a figurehead, and he fades into ever more crazy obscurity as the years proceed.
Yes, what does he get up to? Where does he go?
Well, basically D'Annunzio retreats to this very grand house in the north of Italy, and he makes that his new mission, to develop this extraordinary house, which you can visit actually, called the Vittoriale. I've not been, I really want to go up by the lakes. He gets special stones brought in to create, you know, monuments representing various Italian victories in the Great War. You know, there's yet more carousing. At one point he has a rather unfortunate accident where he falls out of a window, but some suggest perhaps he was pushed. You know, he writes, and throughout the period after 1920, when Mussolini eventually becomes leader in 1922 and eventually establishes himself as dictator, there's this odd relationship between the two of them. You might think it starts off, certainly D'Annunzio, I think, believes that it's master and follower. But of course, as time goes on, it's increasingly clear that Mussolini is the master. He makes D'Annunzio a prince.
Okay.
So, you know, he gets something out of it. He gets a title and a big house.
And he gets away with his escapades in Fiume. He's not really punished for them. The Italian state is not.
No, he's not really punished for them. And I think the question is really, how much does D'Annunzio care? Through all of this, that you get the sense that he's a man who, he's living for the moment. He's seeing what he can do. If something doesn't work out, he moves on. When he's in Fiume, he has various Italian flags stitched with his personal motto, which is "Non mi frego," which literally means "I don't give a damn," and that sums up D'Annunzio. But in this particular case, Fiume, what makes Fiume so important is, first of all, its role in the genesis of Italian fascism, but also it's showing that the Versailles peace agreement can be challenged, because that's what happens in Fiume. You've essentially got the representative not of a defeated state, but of a victor state, Italy, challenging the Versailles peace agreement. And that I think is an example which is taken up by others in the future, that the Versailles peace settlement is not the last word.
And from one instance of performative, celebratory politics, that I feel like that leads us quite nicely onto the next scene of the Second Congress of the Comintern in Moscow. Because this is at a very crucial moment in the revolution's development, and it seems that things could be kind of going quite badly, or perhaps there's a kind of economic distress and poverty, and the regime is at a particular very crucial moment, and yet the Second Congress of the Comintern is this incredibly luxe celebratory event.
It's incredibly lavish, because on the one hand, so the first meeting of the Comintern the previous year, there are a few dozen people who turn up, the Comintern being the Communist International, the gathering together of representatives of communist movements around the world to replace the Socialist International, which is associated with social democratic parties. So this is the Communist International, and it exists to promote revolution around the world. And in 1919, it's a pretty small gathering, quite last minute. There are a few nice gestures. They gather in a room where the floor is painted red, especially for the delegates. But the second iteration in 1920, the summer of 1920, is extremely lavish. They start off actually in Petrograd, and there's a six-hour agitprop performance of the revolution, which of course took place in Petrograd in 1917. And there's newspapers published. There's hundreds of delegates from around the world. The Italians turn up. They bring their own Chianti. There are representatives from Asia, and it is this actually quite hopeful moment from the world revolution perspective, where people think actually the things are going their way. There've been these disappointments in 1918 and 1919. Things haven't quite taken the direction that was expected, and in 1920. In the summer of 1920, Lenin and his cohorts believe that the revolution is going their way, largely because of a military advance taking place at that very moment from Soviet Russia into Poland, and the belief that Warsaw is there for the taking, and that once Warsaw falls, then the path will be open to revolution in Germany or in Italy. So this is they think this is their moment. It's finally arrived, despite the fact that there's all this famine in Russia. And Russian society is falling apart. They believe the world revolution is going their way.
And so to what extent do you feel like all of this performance was a mask for what was going on in Russia? Do you feel like Lenin was very much aware that they needed to put up this front? Because that was the impression that I got somewhat when I was reading it, that he is perhaps aware that they need to put on a good show to all of the other socialists and communists across the world to say, it's working here, it can work with you. And that the performance at the meeting, at the Congress, is really essential for that myth to be propagated.
I think there's an element of that, but I also think they really believe it.
Yeah.
You know, that element of performance is there really throughout the revolutionary period. You go back, it's in 1917, it's in 1918.
Yeah.
You know, one of the very first acts of the regime in 1918 is to command that new statues of revolutionary heroes be erected all over Moscow and Petrograd, and over Russia, in fact.
Mm.
And there is this notion that the minds of the people must be changed. There can be no turning back.
Mm.
And partly you show there's no turning back by terror, but you also present this bright future of the way the world is going and say, look, this is why you shouldn't turn back, because there's something even greater and better to turn towards. This is the inevitable future. This is the world revolution. It's happening now. It's happening here. So I think both those elements come into play. But in the summer of 1920, for a while, it really looks as if, from the perspective of Lenin, there are others around him who are much more sceptical of whether this military adventure towards Warsaw is likely to be successful. But from his perspective, he really thinks that this is going to work. And of course, it doesn't.
Yes.
At the gates of Warsaw, the Red Army, led by a 27-year-old, the Red Army is forced to turn back because the Polish leader, Pilsudski, attacks it in its rear, and basically the Red Army falls back in disarray. And so that moment goes.
And to what extent do you feel like Lenin's belief in the revolution was instrumental in that failure in Warsaw, that he was pushing ahead for a military victory that other people could see was impossible? Or do you feel like it was a reasonable goal to have?
I mean, there's always going to be this tension between, and there always was this tension between those who believe that revolution was inevitable, that it had, if you like, history with a capital H on its side. All you needed to do was push forward and the dam would break somehow and revolution would break out. And those who have a slightly more pragmatic approach and worry whether the time is right. And indeed, Lenin himself often in the past had ummed and ahed about whether, you know, this was the right moment to push ahead for revolution, whether they should hold back. In 1917, for example, he was furious at one time in the summer of 1917 when some of his Bolshevik allies appeared to push for a revolutionary overthrow of a provisional government before he thought Russia was ready for it. So that there is this tension between different characters and also within different characters about this argument in favor of inevitability, and at the same time, knowing whether now is the right time to push. In this case, clearly, Lenin miscalculated.
You spoke in the last scene about D'Annunzio and what a forceful personality he was and how important his personality was to what happened in Fiume. And I know that this year, 1920, has a part to play in the creation of the cult of personality surrounding Lenin.
Yes.
And to what extent is that going on? Maybe you could tell us a bit about that as well.
Yes, I think it's on Lenin's birthday in this year that you get a number of biographies written and published celebrating him. You know, in 1917, 1918, Lenin is essentially the first amongst equals. There's a leadership cohort of which Lenin is one. He's the most significant figure, but he's, you know, only one figure. There's also Trotsky and others. By 1920, you begin to see Lenin pulling away, or Lenin and Trotsky together pulling away as the leaders of the Russian Revolution, the leaders of the Bolshevik movement, really, really unquestioned. And certainly Lenin's incredibly impatient personality.
Call him the impatient revolutionary.
One of the extraordinary things about totalitarian regimes such as the Soviet Union is that they keep records of absolutely everything relating to their leadership and then publish them, which is a great trope for historians looking back on matters 100 years later. And so there's, I think it's maybe 60 volumes, published volumes of Lenin's collected writings, and they cover absolutely everything from his ideological work to notes about, peat farming in Siberia and how things must be always speeded up. One of the interesting things following Lenin after 1917 is actually noticing him become more and more and more impatient with bureaucracy, with red tape, with things not working out the way he expects them to work out. He doesn't, of course, reflect that it's possible that bureaucracy and red tape comes from him in any way, or that the failure of the revolution, essentially. I think he has a sense of the revolution not working out the way he'd expected, not being as simple as he'd expected. And I think that contributes to a growing sense of impatience over the years. But he can't let go of it because that's his life. That's what he's always believed in.
Of course. And the defeat at Warsaw is that must be a real turning point in the revolution.
I think possibly more of a turning point for Lenin personally actually comes a couple of months later. And it's the death of his lover, Inessa Armand. And there is this idea that I think the revolution, sort of the bloom is coming off the revolution slowly in 1920. It gets worse in 1921, 22. And for me, that's represented with the death of Inessa Armand, Lenin's lover, and also with the death of John Reed, who's this extraordinary American communist figure, very heavily romanticized in the film Reds, and the author of 10 Days That Shook the World, which is the standard text often used to describe the Russian Revolution. It's very partial, of course. And John Reed dies also at the end of 1920. And for me, that represents the end of an era where it was thought the revolution could just proceed like a steamroller across Europe after 1920. On the one hand, the Russian Bolshevik state is quite secure. It's not going to collapse, as had been thought in 1918, 1919. On the other hand, the possibilities of world revolution seem much curtailed. And you enter a phase where it becomes more about building communism within Russia.
So how was the defeat in Warsaw taken by the Comintern?
Well, they stop watching events on the little map which they've put in their Congress Hall, and they turn their attention elsewhere. At the end of 1920, or towards the end of 1920, there's actually another Comintern meeting. But this is very different to the one in Moscow. This takes place in Baku, in Azerbaijan. And the focus here is to move from trying to foment revolution in Western Europe, in these advanced industrialized countries, highly capitalized countries, which is where Marx, of course, said that revolution should take place. And energies are turned towards states which have been, or nations which have been colonized. And so in Azerbaijan, you get this extraordinary event where there are dozens of different languages spoken. It's totally chaotic. It all takes place at night because it's too hot during the day. And there are delegates from all over Asia. And the attempt here is to turn the attention of Comintern. If revolution's not going to break out in Western Europe, then maybe we can foment risings in India and Afghanistan and other places, and we can essentially attack capitalism and attack the capitalist states, Britain, France, and America, in this other way through the soft underbelly. The other thing which happens at the end of 1920, which is very important, is that the civil war essentially comes to an end in Russia, because in November 1920, after the succession of Russian generals and one admiral who've led various white armies attempting to overthrow the communists through the civil war, the last of them, Wrangel, is forced into Crimea and eventually forced out of Crimea in November 1920. And there's this extraordinary, pathetic exile of well over 100,000 refugees, both soldiers and civilians, on the last ships of the old Tsarist Russian Navy from Crimea to Istanbul. And so these hundreds of thousands of Russians arrive in Istanbul as refugees. And that then becomes, if you like, the white Russian story, is this the tragic story of these people, many of whom will never see Russia again. Those who do return to Russia may well face questioning or imprisonment or worse. Many of these Russians therefore decide not to return, and they end up spread out through Europe in Prague, in Istanbul, in Paris, the centres of white Russian exiles, and then eventually, of course, in America. Some end up in Tunisia, oddly. A squadron of ships is sent to the French port of Bizerte, French-controlled port of Bizerte in Tunisia. And so there's this sort of rather sad coda to the white Russian endeavour, which Wrangel tried to save, but by November 1920, they're out. And throughout the rest of the book, you know, there's this rather sad exiled group of white Russians who we see in different parts of the world popping up, but eventually fading completely from the historical record, because the only fact that really matters is the success and the existence of the Soviet Union.
Those are highly emotive scenes from the Soviet Union. Was it called the Soviet Union at this time, or not quite?
No, that comes a little later.
I did it for A-level, so I'm touching on glimpses of memories I have. I think it's probably about time to head to our final scene that we're travelling back in time to, which is in Munich. And it's the embryonic kind of stages of the Nazi Party, or certainly Hitler's rise to become this populist leader in Germany. And what if you could pick a specific place to visit in Munich that you feel would capture that moment, where would you like to go?
I think we really have to go to a beer hall.
Okay.
And have a few litres of beer. They have the mass of beer in Munich. So we can go to a beer hall. Maybe we can go to the Hofbräuhaus, which is the best known of the beer halls. But of course, there are many of them. And in 1920, the beer hall was the place where populist politics was happening. In 1919, Munich had been rocked by revolutions from the left, and there had been two Soviet republics in Munich. One led by a playwright called Ernst Toller, and another far more radical, which ended quite tragically, led by a communist called Levinet. And that essentially collapsed because a white army marched in and took back Munich from the communists, an extreme communist sect. So Munich's been through this incredible turbulence and political churn, and it comes out the other side, having been this centre of radical chic, if you like, in 1919 under Ernst Toller, the playwright. It then becomes essentially a centre of political reaction and far-right politics. And the Republican government in Munich tries to essentially inoculate Munich against communism by allowing far-right movements to have their headquarters, essentially, in Munich. So you've got all these different far-right movements, nationalist movements, patriotic movements, movements of paramilitaries, and Hitler's group, and it isn't really yet Hitler's group, but the German Workers' Party, is one of those competing for oxygen, competing for attention in this sort of ideological arms race which takes place in the beer halls of Munich.
And what would those beer halls have been like? Would it have been a raucous environment? What was the kind of particular connection between the beer and the populism, do you feel?
Well, they certainly would have been raucous. Okay. I mean, some of these places were absolutely huge. If you go to Munich, you can go to the room where the German Workers' Party announced their manifesto in February 1920. Has a capacity of around 2,000. So these were loud, brawling places. I don't think people came only for the politics. I think they came partly for the entertainment and obviously for the drink. I think all these things came together and they create this brew, if you like, of this particular kind of Munich politics. Mm. It's quite noticeable or remarkable that the announcement of the manifesto of the German Workers' Party in February 1920 in the Hofbräuhaus, Hitler's name isn't even on the bill poster advertising it.
No, really?
No, they use the name of this guy, Johannes Dingfelder. Dingfelder, I think, who's no longer on the pages of history particularly, but at the time was a local agitator who would have drawn the crowds in. There's no mention of a manifesto being announced, no mention of the German Workers' Party, indeed. Mm. I think they knew you wanted to get an audience in. You get audiences in by giving them controversy, by giving them a speaker who's going to rouse them, by giving them something to listen to while they down their beers over a couple of hours. Mm. And I think that entertainment element actually does have a role to play in explaining the way in which Nazism emerged, and indeed the way in which Hitler,
yes,
who after all is this utterly minor figure, trained as a public speaker by the army and trained essentially in his ramshackle ideology to a degree by the army after the First World War. You know, you explore his development in 1920 and you have to ask yourself, could it have happened in any other environment other than Munich, a city having been through this extraordinary set of political transformations over the previous 18 months, and where there is this physical space available to orators to peddle their wares.
And he seems to really be honing that craft over the year, that what you were talking about, the kind of combination of entertaining and really identifying what it is that really gets people going, and
yes,
going around different places and seeing what sticks, and finding that anti-Semitism really sticks, and then developing that as his brand.
Yes, I mean, I spoke before about this sort of ideological arms race taking place in Munich at the time, where there are all these different groups competing for airtime, for oxygen. If you read Hitler's speeches, and unfortunately I have had to read all of Hitler's speeches from this time, and he tries out a number of different lines. Mm. He starts off actually in 1919, his main line is actually anti-capitalism, particularly against interest and against Anglo-Saxon finance capitalism. And in the manifesto in 1920, that a large part of it is sort of this sort of radical communitarian socialism, but coupled with anti-Semitism and German nationalism. And I think as 1920 goes on, there's more and more of a focus on anti-Semitism as something that holds this completely ramshackle set of ideas together. And it's sort of something he can always go back to. My impression is that if the interest of the audience is flagging, you know, he can go back to anti-Semitism, and that's a way of winding them back up again.
Mm.
It works.
Mm.
With looking at the development of Hitler as an ideologue and as a speaker, it's not just his own intellectual development, reading books, picking up ideas from whoever he met last week. I think it's also in response to what the audience wants and what works for them. And there's that curious relationship between the speaker and audience, which I think he's very good at sensing and developing over the course of 1920, which makes him a success as a political performer, which is what he is.
What would be your assessment of his character at this time? I remember a scene from your book where you talk about him talking his way into the flat of some baron and dressing up as what he believes to be the traditional Bavarian country gentleman.
Yeah.
It's all very awkward and he doesn't really know what he's doing. And it struck me that he's a very awkward person. You kind of get the impression, because what you know of him from later, he's this strong personality, clear set of ideas and principles, so-called. But at this early period, it seems like he kind of is, you know, going from one thing to the other.
I mean, he's basically a sociopath. You know, he goes from being very, very lost, being this utterly marginal figure, you know, who found a home in the army during the First World War. He loses that. With all the demobilization in 1918-1919, he actually remains in the army until 1920 in a propaganda role. So when he's already a speaker for the German Workers' Party, but essentially, I think he finds a purpose. He finds something that he's good at, something that people say he's good at in being a political speaker. But there is this tremendous social awkwardness to him.
Mm.
He wants to make various entrees into Bavarian society. Really, he wants to be respected as an artist.
Mm.
Even if it's a political artist. Many of his contemporaries have left accounts of the awkwardness of him trying that out, you know, dressing in the wrong clothes, turning up and wanting to have a conversation with somebody, but because he's so self-centered, he ends up just giving a political harangue. He ends up turning to his default position, his comfort zone, which is just speaking to 1,000 people about anti-Semitism.
Mm. Mm.
So in a way, he's becoming a, as he sees himself, becoming a leader of men, but is unable to communicate on the other human registers because he's found this one thing that he does appear to be quite good at, which is speaking to large numbers of people.
I think it's interesting that this year feels like quite fertile ground for characters like Hitler and D'Annunzio and perhaps even Lenin as well. The kind of cult of personality that surrounds these people. And this whole period, it just feels very chaotic and like people like this can come to the fore and they can have their moment in the sun. What do you think that perception of the period is only with retrospect? Was there a sense at the time that anybody could have a go at seizing power?
I think people are looking for saviours.
Yeah.
And there was a great book written by a man called Paul Faden, who wrote The Fatherless Society in, I think, 1919, maybe 1920. And Paul Faden was an apostle of Freud. And his argument essentially was that when a society loses, as you alluded to with a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald, when a society loses faith in God, when it loses society in kings, its monarchs, its political leaders, bourgeois political leaders, it needs to find some source of inspiration and leadership, because that's what societies at this time appear to need, maybe always need. And so they'll look for anyone who presents themselves as a political leader, as cranky as they may be, as unpleasant as they may be, and as lowly as they may be. And so you do get, over this period of years, figures like Lenin who can arise from, you know, living in 1917 in Zurich above a butcher's shop to being the Soviet dictator.
Mm.
And people like Adolf Hitler. And indeed others, you know, Mussolini himself is another character who's absolutely fully aware of the opportunities which exist, personal opportunities, political opportunities which exist in a chaotic situation.
Mm.
You know, this period of quote unquote great men is, I think, very strongly associated with the chaos that is so much of what Europe is about in 1920.
I think we're now going to head back to the present, but you're allowed to take one memento with you from the year 1920. So if you could take back any memento, what would it be?
Well, I have two things I'd like to take back.
Okay, we'll allow two on this occasion.
Well, okay. Well, that's very kind of you. That's very kind of you. One thing which I'd like to take back is Lenin's hunting rifle. In researching this book, I found Lenin a totally fascinating character. I had no idea that Lenin was such a major hunter.
Mm-hmm.
He used to calm himself.
Seems so bourgeois.
It is utterly bourgeois. But then in so many respects, he was. He was artistically very, very conservative. In 1920, he has a meeting with the German socialist where he talks about how he just doesn't, you know, he doesn't like all this modern culture, avant-garde stuff. Can't stand it.
Mm.
Hates the poet Mayakovsky. He's, you know, he's very conservative,
mm.
and his love of hunting is. It shows that perhaps underneath this, you know, it's a revolutionary exterior, trapped in a three-piece suit, there's actually this, in some respects, culturally quite bourgeois and conservative character. And I think the hunting rifle for me would represent that. The other thing I'd like to take, if I may, is a tablecloth that D'Annunzio put up for sale in Fiume as part of his raising money. And it's just, as I understand, it's just a tablecloth on which he had spilled some ink, and apparently the ink made an interesting shape. People thought D'Annunzio was such a demigod of Italian politics that they wanted to, and Italian culture, that they wanted to buy this tablecloth. But I think I'd like to have it myself.
Mm.
So if you don't
mind. Do you know if it sold, how much for?
I don't know that.
Enough to fuel one party, maybe for one evening.
Yes, perhaps the first hour of one of their lesser parties. They raised some money also by airlifting some contraband postage stamps to Paris and trying to sell them on the Paris stamp market. So there were lots of, you know, ways of trying to raise money.
Well, the rifle and the tablecloth will do very nicely.
And also, I can transport the rifle in the tablecloth. So
perfect.
It works well.
It works well. Well, thank you so much for taking us on that trip to some of the most charismatic and unusual figures of 1920. Yeah, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
A total pleasure. Thanks very much.
That was me, Artemis Irvin, talking to Charles Emerson about the year 1920 and some of the most charismatic and dangerous personalities from that year. I really enjoyed Charles talking at the end about how the memento he'd like to bring back would be Gabriel D'Annunzio's stained tablecloth, and I could really see it stretched out on his dining room table where we were doing the interview. The book is called Crucible, The Long End of the Great War and the Birth of a New World, and it's published by The Bodley Head. We have a new episode out every week, so you'll have a new one to listen to next Tuesday. But till then,
Goodbye.
Hello and happy new year. I hope you enjoyed Artemis's conversation with Charles Emerson about the year 1920. I'm Peter Moore, and I'm going to be back in a week's time with an episode on the year 1917 and a brilliant biographical study of the London Bloomsbury set. Until then, you can check out all of our old episodes on our website, tttpodcast.com. And thank you very much for listening.